This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/iFanboy. You are listening to iFanboy.com's Talksplode. I am Josh Flanagan. Today we are talking to Ed Brubaker, writer on Captain America, Daredevil, Incognito, the upcoming Marvels project, and the web series Angel of Death. Hey, this is Josh Flanagan from iFanboy.com, and I'm here with Ron Richards.
Hey, Josh.
And our guest today on Talksplode is Ed Brubaker. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing good. How you guys doing?
Very good. You are a busy guy. I'm going through trying to come up with questions and stuff that you're looking at, and there's so many projects that I could talk about with you. I imagine that's you've got stuff going on constantly now.
Pretty much, yeah. I'm trying to get to a point where I only have to work on one thing at a time, which I'm getting pretty close to being there. I think by the end of this month I'll be at a point where I don't have to work on part of an issue of this and then jump over to finish an issue of Captain America or something. So
is that tough creatively to switch gears between projects? Or I mean, is it, you know, can you be in cap mode and then quickly switch back to Incognito, or is it better to space them out?
It's not that tough. I've been doing it on and off for years. I prefer to spend, you know, like 1 week, one project, and then kind of go on to the next project and do it that way, just because I think you get a little bit more just focus in what you're doing. But the hardest part is the outlining. Like, once I've figured out what's going on in the issue, that's the real work, is the thinking part. The actual typing of the script takes 3 or 4 days, and you do a lot of thinking there. But once you kind of know where you're beginning and where you're ending for that issue, that it's not as hard to go like halfway through the issue and then stop and jump over to work on something else. It's hard to work on multiple outlines at the same time. You really can only be thinking about one story while you're figuring out what's going to happen in that issue. And so that kind of, you know, I try to always make sure when I finish one thing, I have the outline for whatever I have to start next already ready. But I've run into a few times just because of business trips or conventions or something where I end up not having enough time to have that. And so I have to sit down and outline an issue of Daredevil and then an issue of Incognito or Criminal, or, you know, and just sit there. And that can be difficult. I'll have days where I just sit on the couch and stare at the ceiling and, you know, I'm really working, but it just doesn't look like it.
That's actually a question, something I've run up against. Like, when you've got to plan what's going to happen, I mean, how do you sit down in front of the computer and just try to hack it out, or you go on walks and try to think of stuff? Or
mostly I sit around, or I have a really small dog, so often I'll just lie on the couch with the dog there and just sort of pet the dog and figure out how, you know, what part of the story I'm stuck on. But I never start typing until I know what order the scenes are going to go in. I don't know any of the dialogue or the narration or anything like that when I start typing, but I know what the scenes are and what order they're going to be in, and that's really the important part to me.
Do you take notes? You know, do you keep a notebook around and always?
Oh yeah, I have tons of notebooks. That's that's the job, really, more than anything, is notebooks. I'm constantly running out of notebooks, as it turns out, too. I have you know, different notebooks for different projects. Like, I have a couple different Captain America notebooks now, and I had a whole notebook that was all just Sleeper, and I think I might have even done some of the Authority in that. But yeah, I just have tons of notebooks, and so when I travel, I end up having to bring like two or three notebooks with me, just because if I'm working on different projects, I have to bring them with me.
Now, can it just be any notebook, or do you need a specific brand and type?
Such a nerd.
I actually need a college ruled spiral binder kind of thing.
Yeah.
But just because that's what I got used to working on. It's getting harder and harder to find good notebooks, I have to say. Like, I go to the Office Depot or something, and it's appalling that that they don't make, you know, notebooks with enough pages or enough lines on them anymore. I guess computers have ruined everything, as usual.
Yeah.
It's great. I've lost the ability to write by hand completely, so I'm fine with that.
Yeah, I've never been able to. I used to write my scripts by hand when I was a cartoonist. Like, I would just write I would do a little sort of very brief outline, similar to what I do now, and then I would just handwrite all the dialogue and panel descriptions and stuff for myself, even though the panel descriptions would often be almost nothing, because I was going to draw it myself, but I typed so much faster than I wrote by hand. I tried to write by hand recently, and it was just not even worth it. I kept getting ahead of myself and writing the wrong words and feeling like a dyslexic or something. So I definitely like to have my outline next to the computer and just be able to sort of reference it and just really burn through on the typing.
So one of the reasons I guess we're talking to you is because of the Angel of Death series, which is sort of one of the big high profile projects you've been had lately. I assume that you're pretty much done with that for the time being.
Yeah, I mean, there's talk of maybe doing a sequel, but I did that last. I started that in August. I wrote it for like most of August and like most of September, and then they started filming right after that.
Was that a story that you'd had, or did it come about when the opportunity came up to get something made?
It was an idea that I had jotted down in I have a notebook where I just write down like crime ideas and ideas for movies sometimes that I may or may never get around to writing a spec. And that was a spec idea that I had, or it was maybe going to be an arc of criminal or something like that. And it was about a hitman who gets brain cancer originally. And then I was talking to someone about it, and they suggested that brain cancer was perhaps not a very sexy thing to have in your story. And then I remembered this documentary I'd seen on PBS like years and years ago about a guy who got stabbed in the brain with a hunting knife and just walked into the ER. It was like this series they were doing about an ER, and that was one of the episodes, was just this guy walking in at the beginning with a knife sticking out of the top of his head. And I thought, oh, that would be kind of cool. Instead of brain cancer, what if it was like a hitman who got stabbed in the brain? And then I just never did anything with it, and John Norris, the producer on Angel of Death, was approaching me to see about getting the rights to Criminal to do for an internet series, and I was already in negotiations with a variety of people on some of those books, so I couldn't do that and wasn't sure I'd want to anyway. And then he mentioned that they'd been talking to Zoe Bell about doing something, and I was a huge fan of hers from Double Dare and Xena and Death Proof, and so I was just like, oh, well, why don't I just create something for her? And like the next day I gave him this pitch for Angel of Death, and I just, you know, I had instantly thought, well, that would be a really cool thing for Zoe Bell. What if she was like a hit woman who gets stabbed in the brain? And so I just sent that in, and kind of miraculously they loved it, and everybody at Sony loved it, and Zoe loved it, and it just kind of went off without a hitch, which is not usually how things go in Hollywood.
What was it like, I guess, working on a project that has so many other people involved, that as opposed to a comic book where it's just sort of you and an artist and maybe an editor?
They both have their advantages. I mean, I don't get a lot of dumb notes on my comic stuff. I try to tend to write bulletproof scripts and really talk out what I'm going to do with my editors ahead of time, so they're not surprised by what I'm doing. The horror stories of Hollywood that you hear are stuff like that, where it's like the the studios give you really stupid notes or this or that. But I didn't actually run into any of that on Angel. Like, I know Paul, our director, had like some notes meetings with Sony after my first draft or after my like episode outline thing, and he sort of encapsulated all of that into like a page or two of, you know, here's what the notes are, and most of them were stuff that I agreed with, and if there was something I didn't agree with, I could explain why I didn't agree with it, and didn't really get a lot of flack. So I didn't mind it, and I liked being on set and you know, seeing the filming of it and everything. It was a lot of fun. It's, you know, I'm more of a control freak, so there were moments where I was like, oh, I would have inflected that word differently or something. But, you know, that's film, and everybody, it's a lot of fun. I mean, all the seeing the actors sort of bring their own interpretation to the story that you wrote is part of the magic of it, I think. And I don't know. I they each have their, you know, it was good after that to be able to go back and sit in my room and just write and know exactly what I was going to get. But, you know, even with comics, you don't always get exactly what you expect it to be. You know, Sean often will draw a panel completely differently than I pictured it in this when I was writing the script. And that doesn't, you know, that's kind of the collaboration part of it. And often what he draws is better than how I was picturing it. You know, most of the time it is. Every now and then it's not. And I'm like, hey, can you fix that?
So you said that the experience with Angel of Death was, you know, it wasn't very stressful. There wasn't a lot of changes. Do you think that's because it was being made for distribution on the internet? Do you think Sony let it kind of be on its own a little more? Or do you think that they treated it just like a movie?
I think they treated it just like a movie. It was lower budget. It was $1 million budget or just over $1 million. And so I think any $1 million picture gets a little bit less people looking at it than a $50 million picture. But also, Michael Stradford and Robbie Huckle, who were the guys who sort of spearheaded the project through Sony, were really big supporters of it and big fans of my comic stuff. And Paul and John were big fans of my comic stuff. And we all were on the same page about what kind of movie we wanted to make. And, you know, we got Ron Yuan, who's this fantastic stuntman and stunt coordinator, who, you know, everybody was kind of doing it because they wanted to do it, and everybody wanted to make something really cool. And I think the fact that it was going to be on the internet and that they were, you know, you can't discount the fact that they were trying to get some product for the internet really quick after the writer's strike.
Right.
You know, and Dr. Horrible had come out and done so well. And you know, it's just, I think the fact that we were on such a tight schedule maybe helped on some level, because they started filming 2 weeks after my final draft was turned in, and I wrote three drafts in, you know, 6 or 7 weeks while I was writing like 3 or 4 comics at the same time. So it was a busy time. I mean, when I was done with my final draft, I felt like my eyes could barely see. But I think it was, you know, partly that they just wanted to create something really cool and do something, you know, different for the internet, that, you know, we don't have any people standing there talking to a camera or anything, you know, not that there's anything wrong with that. Dr. Horrible does that a few times and it's really great. But I felt like so much of what was on the internet as far as entertainment created for the internet was all about being the internet. It's like if every comic book was about it, the fact that it was a comic book too, you know, at some point the characters notice that they're in panels or something, and it's like so much of internet entertainment was people talking directly to the camera, and we just made a movie, you know, which I thought was really cool that, you know, we were basically saying, well, as far as I'm concerned, the internet is just a middleman getting product from, you know, from creator to viewer, and, you know, I mean, 7 million people have watched Angel of Death now, so that's more than a lot of movies that come out.
That's great. So you get feedback on how many people have viewed it and what the kind of, you know, it's been out for a few weeks now.
Here and there. Like, we knew Sony had ideas about how many people would watch it during the first 2 months, and I think we blew past that before even the first week was over.
Like, oh, that's great.
Yeah, I mean, you create something cool for the internet, and anybody can see it, you know, just about. I mean, though not in Europe, apparently, as I heard from a lot of friends who complained. But I think hopefully that'll be rectified soon. But yeah, I think, you know, I wish they'd put it on iTunes, too, for downloads, because I know a lot of people would prefer to download stuff than stream it. That was my one complaint that I would have with Sony, was that once we'd gone through the 2 weeks on Crackle, I wish they'd also offered it for, you know, like downloads for iPods and iPhones and stuff. But you know, we've had a ton of views, and it's gotten me a lot of notice in Hollywood. That's for sure.
So there's something made
for $1 million. That's pretty amazing.
This is going to be more screenwriting in the future, then, I assume.
I hope so. Yeah, I like doing it.
Is it a different writing process doing that, or did it feel like a new sort of set of muscles to be flexing?
Not so much. I mean, I've written screenplays before just for stuff that hasn't gotten made, or at least hasn't gotten made yet. And like 6 or 7 years ago, I had a short story that Jason Lutz and I did called The Fall, optioned by David Goyer, and he sort of trained me in screenwriting like during this process. Like I wrote like 3 different drafts of that sort of under his tutelage, and so I knew, you know, how to screenwrite, and I actually think screenwriting in a lot of ways is easier than comic book writing.
Because you don't have to stop and isolate
those moments. But there's things you can do in comics that you can't get away with in screenwriting too. So, you know, you can't get away with the heavy narration as much, you know, unless you're Wong Kar-wai. And you know, there's just certain things that make, you know, I think you can get more information across in a comic book than you can in a film a lot of the time. So there's different, you know, each stage have their different challenges, but the easiest part of writing for me is generally, once I've figured everything out, just writing. And screenwriting, you know, with comics writing, the thing about dialogue is you want to write dialogue that sounds real but doesn't take up too much space in each panel or each page. So it's a real challenge to write stuff that doesn't sound forced or too short but also isn't too long, whereas in screenwriting you can let the conversations really breathe and be more real. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think that's actually the biggest problem with the Watchmen movie, was that they used the dialogue from the comic, which was intended to be read, not spoken.
Yeah.
And you know, when I was watching Watchmen, I was just thinking, oh, I wish they'd rewritten all this dialogue so that it didn't sound like Alan Moore's, you know, very artfully written scene transition dialogue that isn't, you know, when you read it out loud, even if you're Carla Gugino, you know, and you're a great actress and you're drop-dead gorgeous, it still sounds like, you know, dialogue written to be read on a page. And, it, you know.
Absolutely. Just, that they were damned if really they did, damned me. If they don't.
Yeah.
I guess switching back to comics, one of the things that we've never actually spoken to you about is the earliest thing I think that I know of that you did was A Complete Low Life, in which you wrote and drew it. Now you're normally known as a writer, but I mean, at a time you said earlier you were a cartoonist. Was that the first sort of major work that you did, or what was that born from? Were you trying to get into comics with that, or?
I was. You know, I started doing comics when I was a little kid, and I only started writing stories so I would have something to draw, really. And my uncle was a screenwriter, and so I always imagined that you could grow up to be a writer or an artist, or, you know, I was sort of raised reading comics. And I think when I was, like, 19, I published a comic through Slave Labor called Purgatory USA that was sort of what Low Life grew out of. And then I guess most of my early 20s, so I was about 25 or 26, I would do, you know, a comic every 6 months or so. I would publish an issue of Low Life, and that was A Complete Low Life. It's a collection of the best of those things. But I always felt very limited by my own artistic abilities. My art tended to grow out of, you know, wanting to be either Gilbert Hernandez or Dan DiCarlo, and you know, you can only do so much with a very art, you know, at least I could only do so much with this sort of, you know, Archie like art style. And I had a lot of ideas for stories that I didn't have the ability to draw at all. And you know, I think I quit cartooning just at the point where I was starting to get good at it, actually, but I was also starting to get a lot of paying writing work. People would read my comics and ask me to do a story for them, and I started collaborating with people, and it was so much more satisfying in some ways to write a story and have Eric Schanauer draw it, or have, you know, Sean Phillips or Michael Lark draw these things, and, you know, and they could come out on a regular schedule as opposed to, like, twice a year. And with my cartooning, I knew it was going to take me, you know, 4 to 6 months at least to draw a single issue, just because I was not, you know, very disciplined with it, and I was always unhappy with what I was doing. So I just labored over it, and And so to sit and write a story that you knew was going to take that long, it got to the point where I could never finish a script that I thought was worth spending that amount of time on. And, you know, and just as you get older, the things that you're interested in change. I like to refer to it as being comics journal damaged from the point where I was like about 16 till I was about 25. And I felt like everything that you did had to be this very important high art kind of thing. And I'd kind of turned my back on a lot of the things that I actually enjoyed in life. And, you know, I realized I enjoyed good science fiction. I enjoyed good crime fiction. And I enjoyed, you know, a lot of different stuff, and, you know, other than, you know, reading Bukowski all the time or some crap like that. And, you know, it just, I think I got to a point where I could re-embrace the qualities of comic books that I had loved growing up. And, you know, I mean, I'm not the world's hugest superhero comic fan, but I like adventure fiction and I like science fiction and, you know, I like stuff like that when it's good. I mean, 98% of everything is crap, but, you know, Philip K. Dick is great most of the time, and you know, same with James P. Blaylock and Tim Powers, and, you know, there's a lot of authors that I read now that I would have just turned my nose up at when I was 25. You know, even Ross McDonald, who was probably the biggest influence on my writing, I wouldn't have given the time of day before I was, you know, before I had kind of decided to re-embrace that kind of pulp roots of you know, my childhood.
It's funny because, I mean, when I first sort of started reading your stuff, which is probably around 2000 or so, you know, everything was very, there was a lot of sort of street level stuff, and, you know, you're known as a crime book guy. And then as your career has progressed, like you know, you start doing The Authority, and then, you know, you did the X-Men. Was that stuff that you'd always, I guess eventually you didn't want to do it at first, but, I mean, did you surprise yourself by, you know, doing good jobs with that stuff, or sort of getting out of your comfort zone, I guess?
Well, kind of. I mean, I'm not really surprised. I always try to, I remember Alan Moore in some interview talked about how he kind of wanted to do every genre and do it as well as he could. And that's kind of how I always felt when I was, you know, especially back before I started working on The Authority. I just, you know, I've for years always said that I would love to do a romance comic because I love those old genre meter romance comics. And we always forget that Kirby didn't just create the Fantastic Four and the New Gods. He also created romance comics. Mm. And, you know, I like every genre of comics. I would, you know, I always joke that when I retire, I'm going to write Jughead comics for a living, and that's my idea of retirement. And it's pretty true, though. I mean, that would be my idea of retirement, getting up every morning and writing a Jughead story. You know, they're easy. He just doesn't like Big Apple, and he wants to eat a lot. he's the ultimate stoner.
Yeah, totally.
but I don't know. I've always sort of wanted to try to do everything. You know, as far as The Authority and the X-Men go, The Authority, I think, was easier than working on the X-Men because everybody in The Authority pretty much just has one power. And you know, I got to tap into my sort of science fiction bent and try to have some fun with that and just sort of play around with readers' expectations. And I loved the idea of a city of infinite Jennies and all that stuff. I don't know how completely happy I am with any of that stuff that I did or how good a job I actually did, but, you know, I tried. And with the X-Men, though, they all have so many powers, it seems like, other than the early ones where it's just like, I open a visor and blast stuff at people. It's like, it got to the point in the 90s where it seemed like every character had like 8 different powers, and, you know, at some point, all of them had a power to just aim their hand at somebody and blast energy at them. So I have trouble keeping track of too many powers, which is why I like the street level characters and why I like the sort of more espionage-y stuff in Captain America, because, you know, it's really easy to keep track of all that stuff. And, you know, the X-Men, the funnest part of the X-Men is it is basically a giant romance comic. You know, it's a giant soap opera, and that's a lot of fun. But I feel a little bit more comfortable on books like Daredevil or Captain America or like Gotham Central, where I can write the more, you know, reality based, you know, for lack of a better word,
semi believable,
right? semi reality based. Well, at least, you know, where every character doesn't have 8 different powers, it just gets to be hard to figure out how to make the fights work. You know, I talked to Marv Wolfman about this years ago. He said the biggest problem with the Teen Titans was that Kid Flash could have solved everything before the rest of them even got to the Titans jet. But it's the same thing with the X-Men. It's like if Nightcrawler's there, pretty much the power of teleportation is all you need. You know, I remember when Mark Millar and John Romita did that run on Wolverine where there was that Gorgon guy who supposedly has 1,000 superpowers, and I'm like, well, name them. You know, like, what are the 1,000? Because if he has teleportation, he doesn't really need the other 999, because that's pretty much all you need.
if you can teleport, you
can win any fight.
I mean, that was the one frustrating thing about that storyline, is because it was just like he seemed unbeatable, and they never really explained it. That's a good point. So,
I like the whole, you know, I like that storyline a lot, actually, but it just Mark has that facility, and I just don't have it. Like, Mark probably could name the other 999 superpowers, even if one of them is, you know, I can always step on an ant, you know, or something. Like, Mark could probably name that because, you know, he thinks in a different way about that stuff than I do, which is something I'm jealous of with his big superhero fights. You know? So he also has Brian Hitch most of the time, so you can go, and then 5,000 people appear, and then he'll actually draw it all. Whereas most of us have to write 5,000 people appear to get the artist to draw 50.
You're almost done with Daredevil. You've been on it for a while, handing it off to Andy Diggle. Now, when Bendis gave it to you, you got Matt being stuck in prison. His life's completely wrecked. And I remember before we knew who was taking over, we thought, whoever that next guy is, he's screwed. And you picked it up and did a really good job with it. Now, are you leaving Diggle with a big mess? Or?
Yeah, totally.
Okay, cool.
Awesome.
That's the plan. That's why I decided to leave there, because I realized it would be a really, really fucked place to leave the next guy. I mean, Brian is one of my best and oldest friends, and we planned that, you know, but I basically had told him, you know, here's what I'm thinking about doing with Daredevil, and you know, I'm thinking at the end of my first storyline, he'll go to jail for all the stuff that happened in yours. And he's like, well, how would you like to have your storyline begin with him in jail? And I was like, okay. Because I was figuring there's no possible way anyone will quit reading the book at that point, which was the big fear, was that people would jump ship. And and so when I was, I think I was plotting out the Return of the King storyline, and I got to the point where I knew, you know, where it was going to end and what was going to happen with Matt's life at that point. And I just thought, you know, if I was going to leave the book, this would be the best place to do it. And I knew at some point in the next year or two, I would probably have to leave a book because I was taking on so much other work and screenwriting possibilities were coming up. And I just thought, I don't really want to leave Daredevil, but I don't think there's going to be another really, really fucked place to leave the next writer after this for a while, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to have to leave without like sort of leaving the next writer with the Daredevil challenge, basically. So I just, you know, I was on a plane to New York when I realized it, and I got to the office and pulled my editor aside, and I said, so I think issue 500 is going to be my last issue, actually. And he was like, what? And then I explained my reasoning, and he was like, oh, okay, yeah, that does make sense. And it is one of those, you know, like, I fear for Andy. Not only is he the first Brit to ever write Daredevil, but he's picking up, you know, at a really, really messed up spot. So,
I assume that involves Kingpin's return. I know you don't want to probably reveal what's happening, but I mean, you're building up, and what you've done with the Kingpin, I think, is really interesting because you've made it, you know, this kind of big, you know, fat criminal guy who, you know, is the villain. You've made him relatable.
Yeah,
you know, to the point where you kind of feel bad for it. You kind of feel bad for him at this point.
Well, you did back in the Miller days too, the Frank Miller issues, like when his wife got blown up and he was kind of like, I like that era of Kingpin a lot. So, you know, and yeah, he is the you know, a really, really bad guy. But I like trying to take those characters and make them, you know, relatable. I, you know, one of my favorite Marvel projects that I did was the Books of Doom, which was the sort of life story of Dr. Doom up until the point where he seized the throne. And I liked getting into his head and really kind of seeing him narrate his own story where he's the hero of the story. Yeah. You know, there was no bad guys in that. There were everybody, you know, everybody but him was the bad guy, basically. And so I really like taking those characters and trying to add dimension to them and make them more relatable, though. you know, wait till you see the next few issues, though. Kingpin is not all he is showing to people, that's for sure. But yeah, I'll tell you, the end of 500, of course, is Matt and the Kingpin get married.
Wow.
Because they're legalizing gay marriage in New York anyway.
Right, so, yeah.
They don't travel to Iowa.
Yeah, they don't have to. They don't have to go anywhere. Patterson's. No. Wouldn't that be the best ending?
It really would.
Yeah. All this fighting all these years has just been about unrequited love.
Yeah, exactly.
There's your romance
comic.
That's
what Kingpin's wife was trying to say.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and then the book comes back, and it's The Many Loves of Matt Murdock. Number one.
That's a great direction to take it in. I applaud that. That's fantastic.
Yeah, well, that's what Diggle wanted to do.
Yeah, well.
There'll be almost no internet reaction from that at all.
Yeah. None.
Speaking of, I guess, taking a bad guy and reforming him or showing the layers of him, when you're writing Incognito and you've got sort of a main character who's a bastard, I mean, what are you thinking about in order to make the audience sort of care about what happens to him?
Boy, I don't know. I just write it how it feels right. honestly, I think all of us at some level have, especially if you've ever worked a job, have that sort of hatred of all humanity and the desire to, you know, if you could do anything and get away with it. I think that's something like what 100 Bullets kind of started out being, like what if you could murder anybody and get away with it? And, you know, the idea of this is much more complex. It's, you know, what if you used to be, you know, a guy like Henry Hill where the rules didn't apply to you and suddenly you have to, like, be a nobody, be a schlub? That's kind of where it spun out of, was that last scene in Goodfellas where I was always thinking, well, I want to see the movie that happens after this. I want to see, you know, Goodfellas you saw... 2, the boring years. Like,
but
that would actually be...
Did you see My Blue Heaven? With Steve Martin?
Is that the Steve Martin one? No, I don't think I've watched that one.
Oh, you've got to rent that then.
Yeah. I saw the whole 10 yards and the whole... I saw the whole 9 yards and the whole... I don't know if I've seen the whole 10 yards. But I'm pretty sure I saw the whole 9 yards.
Those are bad.
Those are terrible. My Blue
My Blue Heaven is good. I mean, it's jokey and it's a comedy, but I mean and like Nora Ephron did it, I think, and like and the premise was it was a sequel to Goodfellas. It was that same idea.
Really?
So you should check it out.
Okay.
Yeah, but anyway.
I'll have to check that out when I'm done with Incognito. One of my favorite comic book movies is History of Violence. The one that David Cronenberg made, that Josh Olson wrote. I love that movie. I like it better than the book, actually. And I just like that idea of somebody who used to be, you know, somebody else sort of becoming, you know, something new. But with Incognito, it's more the guy is sort of forced to be in this world as his only means of survival, and he hates it. And so I liked the idea of, like, what would you do if you were like that and you had these powers and, you know, but you can't use them the way you used to and they start to come back? Like, what do you start going out and, like, stopping crimes just so that you can feel alive again? And, you know, what does that do to you over time? Do you start to actually, you know, do you not even realize that you start to care about people if you're living around them? And, you know, it sort of gets into the nature of good and evil to some degree, you know, of, you know, human nature and why, you know, like, I think evil is incredibly, you know, evil and selfishness and things like that are just incredibly selfish and easy things. I think, you know, it's much harder to have compassion for people, and it's much harder to try to be a decent person. You know, that's why we see, you know, so many, you know, conservatives who claim to be Christians who want to trample all over everyone else's rights and not pay taxes and hoard all their money and, you know, like, you know, I know good conservatives, but it seems like the most ones that you see on TV, I'm just like, how is it, you know, why do you have to be so fucking evil?
Yeah.
You know, and it just really seems like that. And so that's kind of a lot of what the series is actually about, is about the human nature and which one is harder and which one is easier and which one is more rewarding. And you know, it gets to that within this really fucked up story about a guy who in the first scene puts on a Santa costume and date rapes a girl at the office party.
That's a good way to start.
Yeah, which I don't advocate.
Why,
just FYI.
Why flip around? Just get to the point.
Yeah.
Santa rapists. I guess the one last thing that I wanted to ask you about before we get going is a project you're working on the Marvels project.
Oh yeah.
How's that going? Is it difficult to reinvent the origin of the Marvel universe?
Oh, not at all. It's all there. I mean, conveniently, they did it the first time already. No, it's been a blast actually. And wait till people see Steve Epting's art on this. It's by far the best art he's done in his entire career. And it's kind of a dream project for both of us. I think this was, you know. I realized when Tom offered me the job, I went and looked at everything and sort of did some research and got my friend Jess Nevins to help me research the early days of Marvel, and realized that there was so much fertile material there that, you know, I mean, the only time we've seen it done any justice in the way modern comics are told was Marvel's, which was sort of the beginning of you know, I think, the way modern comics are told, this sort of widescreen, you know, broad, you know, taking the stuff seriously. And really, the first issue of Marvel's goes over, you know, 10 years of stuff, basically. It's like, so to be able to sit there and tell this epic story that, you know, I'm trying as hard as possible not to just cover the same stuff that was in Marvel's, but to look back at these characters and the time period and tell this really sort of character-driven espionage story about those early days, the pre-war, you know, pre-war days of the Marvel Universe, is really a lot of fun because I'm able to weave, you know, real history with fake Marvel history, and that's just been a blast. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we get to see the first time the Submariner, you know, like, actually comes into contact with surface people and why he hates them, and you know, it's really a lot of fun to sort of get to the espionage aspects of that, because you realize when you look back at that era of the real world, you know, there was so much espionage going on, you know, pre-war and, you know, during the early days of the war in Europe and you know, but before America got in, and looking at the Marvel history of, you know, wow, a Human Torch is created, and, you know, a German scientist, you know, defects to America to, you know, to help create the Super Soldier, and, you know, all this stuff, and you look at that and you think, this is pretty fascinating, you know, and a lot of it has not been really approached in any way in the way we tell comic stories these days. You know, I mean, I'll be able to actually get into, you know, how the Human Torch decided he was a person in some way or another, and decided that he was a hero, you know, because there was this whole period of time where when he was, after he escaped and learned to control his flame, where he actually became a cop in New York for a while. So we'll be able to actually tell this sort of sweeping historical epic, and, you know, each character gets, you know, gets their own story in a way, and they all kind of weave around each other. So it's a lot of fun. I keep saying it's kind of like the right stuff for the Marvel Universe, but it really is. It's, you know, as if John Le Carre had written the right stuff, you know, or Graham Greene or somebody, you know, not that I'm nearly the writer either of those guys were, but.
Well, that's what's interesting, because like DC's really mined the Golden Age with the JSA and the idea of legacies and their universe and stuff like that. Marvel really hasn't touched on the Golden Age that much at all, other than that one issue of Marvel's.
So, yeah, I mean, they did when I was growing up, there was the Invaders, you know, yeah. which I loved. And
well, I meant more in recent days. I mean, like Avengers West Coast, maybe?
We deal with it in Cap with our flashbacks and things like that. But yeah, it's not something that they've spent a lot of time doing. So, you know, I mean, that was the other thing when Tom called me up to offer me the job. It was really the, you know, this is going to be the, you know, the centerpiece of Marvel's 70th anniversary. And it's like, wow, well, you know, that's pretty amazing. And to do this thing, if people want to know, like, so how did things start in the Marvel Universe? This will be the project. You can go, you know, you can give them this book when it's out. And
no pressure there.
Project like that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, conveniently, I've got, you know, all the material is there, and I get to invent a lot of cool stuff. But, you know, even just picking through, you know, the stuff they did in the modern days that dealt back with those pastimes, you know, you can find out, like, oh, well, who were the German spies that were over here? And, you know, it doesn't take, you know, but 10 minutes of research to find out who those people actually were, and you can figure out what they were doing, you know, so it's right. Like, that's really neat, you know, that there's this big untold espionage story, actually, and I get to tell it.
Cool.
When you're reading through all those Golden Age comics, I mean, as a comic writer, and obviously, like, you study how comics are made and how stories are told, was there anything sort of surprising about reading that stuff back then? Did you see stuff you didn't expect to, or?
Not really. I mean, I've read a lot of that stuff growing up, and in the reprints and stuff like that. And, you know, some of them are amazing. You know, you got Bill Everett, and there's a lot of really cool art in it, but, you know, most of it is written for 5-year-olds or less. You know, so it's not, you know, it's nothing to write home about. Most of it. There's some cool art, but most of the stories are pretty basic, and, you know, they're 8-page or 11-page stories and in giant, you know, books that had tons of stories. But the most interesting character to me that I've come across in this is the Angel, who was in the first issue of Marvel Comics. But the Angel and Kazar were actually the only two characters that survived from when Martin Goodman's publishing line was doing pulp magazines, and then started publishing Timely Comics. Like, the Angel and Kazar both came over to be comic book characters, but none of the other ones did. And so the Angel has this crazy pulp hero history that's sort of like this weird Doc Savage meets, you know, I don't even know what kind of history. And he's got a really fascinating backstory and is a really, really intense and interesting character. And he's not even around in modern times. So I thought that was really fascinating. I love the pulp roots of comic books. And I think, you know, I always regret that comics got so far away from the pulp roots and sort of sissified themselves almost instantly, because, you know, it's different when you've got pictures of things happening instead of sentences, because you don't expect a 4-year-old to read necessarily like an 80-page pulp story so that he finds out that, you know, the spider is disemboweling people and strangling them with their own entrails, you know. but you know, in the comic books, that's kind of a no-no. But, you know, we forgot Batman used to carry a gun, and Superman used to throw slumlords off the roofs of tenements and stuff and kill them. So
yeah, it was a lot harsher back then.
Yeah, and I mean, there's no way you can be a Human Torch and throw fireballs at bad guys and not kill them. Right. So I like being able to sort of address that stuff in a more modern way, and to sort of get into the horror of, you know, Nazi experimentations to try to create a super soldier and things like that, because, you know, why did Dr. Erskine, you know, defect to America? Like, well, look who he was working for. So there's really interesting stuff in there to really get into.
And cool. When's that? When do we see that?
July. I think it's July.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's this summer. Yeah. I can't wait to see that Epting art. He's just been so good working with you.
There's a big preview. We have our prologue preview. It should be in, I think, this issue, some upcoming issue of Wizard. It's we got it all done, so it must be really soon.
Well, you got to get going, and we covered a lot of stuff in a short amount of time.
Yeah.
I'm amazed all right. at our effectiveness. So
thank
you very much. I appreciate it. We want to thank Ed for spending some time talking to us. Make sure you check out all his work and get to iFanboy.com to comment on this show and find all sorts of other great stuff there. Thanks.